in that sense, you might have said that, yes, there was a feeling of change. It wasn't until a few years after statehood that what we call now, or what we call then, big money began appearing in Anchorage. Property values increased substantially. The larger buildings began to be built. There was a feeling of permanency about the state, whereas the general attitude in the past during territorial days mostly was that come up, make it in a few years, and get the hell out again. So we didn't have many permanent structures. Juneau had a few because it was a much older community than Anchorage was. But Fairbanks, even though Fairbanks was older than Anchorage, they didn't have any real permanent structures up there either. And it wasn't until after statehood when the people became, well, not more attached to the land, but more conscious of the fact that we were an entity of the United States, I think that the change began to take place. And when I say the change began to take place, it was probably along with the oil investigations and our control of the fishing industry that created this atmosphere. When I was in the legislature, Senator Victor Rivers, who was a very, very good friend of mine, and he and I were on the Banks and Banking Committee and in the Senate. And we proposed a regulation whereby there should be a moratorium of 10 years on taxes for new major industries that would come in. And that is the one bill that we did get by that brought in the Ketchikan pulp mill and provided a good number of permanent jobs for a good long time there in Ketchikan. And I suspect it probably brought in some other industries as well. But that was just one of the very, very few things that we could do as a territory. But once the statehood got rolling and the gas was struck down here in the Kenai, we got a hold of our own fisheries. I think then it was the real turnaround in Alaskan thinking about permanency.
I'm going to bring you to the judges a little. Judge McCarran, what did people think of Judge McCarran?
Well, with all due respect to the old suit salesman, I would say that he wasn't a very popular judge.
Why not?
Well, he didn't have law in his mind. He just wasn't an attorney in the sense that you think of an attorney having an acute, astute, sharp ability to judge. McCary wasn't, as far as I can remember, McCary wasn't a popular judge. And the reason he wasn't, I think, is he just wasn't a sharp attorney. Mm-hmm. He never was. And I don't say this in necessary denigration. Some people have intelligence limitations, and that's all there is to it. He just didn't have it.
Yeah. Judge Fulton.
A very, very intelligent man, sharp as a razor. He was the Interior Department solicitor for a good number of years. But Fulton was a tough, hard-boiled, honest, absolutely impeccably honest judge. I don't know whether Fulda ever made a bad decision. I can't ever remember any of his cases ever being reversed. Now, they may have been, but I don't know that he ever made a bad decision. Fulda was a good attorney. He was a good judge.
Judge Diamond.
Well, Judge Diamond was a kind of a frontier judge. He was austere and always fair. To my knowledge, he was always impeccably honest. And I think he was probably, because of his mining background, he gave maybe more liberal consideration to certain types of legal cases than maybe some other judges would have. But Tony Diamond was quite a popular judge, and it wasn't necessarily because he was popular socially, because he wasn't. He was a very retiring, shy man, and he had one stiff leg and kind of about a half of one eye. But he was honest and forthright, and And as I recall, if you ask him a question, why he told you like it was, not like you might want to hear.
Mm-hmm. Who was he disposed to because of his mining background?
Well, I don't say he was disposed necessarily to anyone, mm-hmm. but because of his mining background, he had a broader knowledge of a lot of things that might pertain in frontier law, mm-hmm. Property rights, water rights, and all that sort of thing. He had a broader knowledge of that kind of thing than probably many of the other judges did, except a person like Wickersham, of course. Consequently, probably applied a good deal more frontier type of justice to things than some attorney who was not schooled in that pioneering background. I mean, does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
It does. The reason I ask you too is because of Fairbanks, where many of the people were mining.
Yes.
Judge Helmfall.
Well, I traveled quite closely with Judge Helmfall for quite a long time, and Judge Helmfall was rather, I can't think of the term. Not volatile, but
argumentative?
Not necessarily. No. He was a little inclined more to, I think, to make his judgments based on personal response to the situations.
Emotional?
That's one of the terms you could use, yes. Probably more of emotional type of thing than. Although I think he made some pretty hard and fast decisions, but I would say that oftentimes his decisions were based on hunches. But in the criminal area, why, of course, he gave everybody a fair opportunity. So I would say that he was neither an outstanding judge nor an exceptionally poor one.
Did you know Judge Forbes?
I knew him, but I didn't know anything of his law practice at all in Fairbanks. No, I didn't know anything of his law practice.
Pratt?
No.
Let's go to I can't remember the name. One down in... Juno in the early days. Alexander?
Judge Alexander?
Yes.
Oh, well, he was something else again. I only knew Alexander just from occasional meeting, but some of the stories that emanated from the area was that he was a little bit inclined to dip into the jug, and that his jurisprudence didn't always rely on the law, in the sense that sometimes his judgments weren't according to the law of the book.
Whose law were they according to?
Alexander's.
Oh, writing new law in Juno.
That's right.
In the 1960s, Stanley teamed up with Cliff Groen. Can you tell me something about that partnership?
Well, I can't tell you any more than they practiced for quite some time, and the firm had been doing a lot of work for the Tyonics, and I'm not sure. Stanley didn't ever tell me all about it. I'm not sure just how the difficulty arose in that organization. But Stanley, of course, as I told you before, was always pretty liberal with the natives over there as far as fees were concerned. And it may be that because Cliff had been doing some of the work, that he wanted his fees and he wanted them full measure. And at that time, there was a chap was under charge of murdering his wife here, and Stanley was involved in that case for, I guess, a year and a half, and won the case because he got the proper evidence and cleared the fellow, which was proper and just because the guy didn't do it. And I guess during this time that he was involved in this case, the other several partners got together and they just voted him out of the association. So in essence, moved his desk out, period. So what all the ramifications were, I don't know, because Stanley didn't ever tell me, but I know that later on why Cliff Grohl wanted to, he was involved in other of the Indian Claims Act work. And it seems to me that they wanted to charge $1 million or $1.5 million for their services. Well, Stanley didn't feel that was just because Stanley had caused the Secretary of Interior, I think he had caused the freezing of all the lands beforehand so that the oil pipeline couldn't get through, because he and I had a couple of arguments about that. I said, look, we got to get this oil pipeline going. Oh, I said, no way. He says, not until the Indians get their money. So I knew that he had a hand in getting that done. So anyhow, in the course of the subsequent work by his firm and with Grohl, Grohl said there was considerable monies due. Well, by the time they got all of the attorney's fees involved in that, why, it amounted to some considerable piece of money. And I know, although Senator Stevens has never said to me anything about it, Stanley inferred that he had made a deal with Senator Stevens that there was only going to be a certain percentage of that money, whatever it was that came from the federal government, could be given to attorneys, because the attorneys were out of the big hand. And consequently, I think it probably cost Grohl's billing probably 3/4 of the billing. And there was no way that they could prove otherwise. So I guess that Stanley, in a sense, got even with Grohl for throwing him out of the corporation by making that, which was a logical deal. I think it was a logical deal. So Stevens was doing nothing other than protecting the natives. And my brother was incidental in getting the natives protected as well. So, but prior to the time that they entered into this partnership arrangement, or association, I should say, they had done quite a lot of legal work together. Grohl ran his own office down on when he was there on 4th Avenue. Let's see, this must have been in the, when was it? 60s? Let's see, I lost my place of business in the earthquake in 64. So that must have been in the early 60s that Grohl had his office just down the street from my brother's office on 4th Avenue. And I know that they used to do quite a lot of work on different cases together. And I wish I knew more about what the blow-up was in the organization, but I know that Stanley said, well, he says, one day I went in, he says, you don't live here anymore, you're out. And he said, what happened? Well, we just voted you out, period. That was the end of that. So that's all I know about that.
What did you do after that?
Well, then he opened his own office with Young Greening. And he had him in his office for quite a while, and then he kind of finally retired out of that and didn't do much anymore, and just stayed at home.
Why?
Well, for one thing, I guess he wasn't feeling too well. For another thing, he was tapping the jug pretty heavy. And he had taken quite a buffeting over the period of the years, like his years in the legislature and then later on when they were fighting over the bank and then fighting over the Palmer Airport and then whatever else, and plus the altercation with Groh in the group, and I think he just defeated him. He didn't have a personality like mine, because in the legislature they call me the hatchet man. You know, you can't down me, I'll pop up somewhere again and fighting. And although he was a very sharp attorney, he was a very sensitive person, very sensitive person. And I just feel that the buffeting he had taken, and both in the political field and the field of law, well, not in the field of law, but with this particular situation and the investigations, the IRS, and them trying to hang a red flag on him and all the rest of stuff, I think it just finally wore him down. Mm-hmm. And I suppose he had enough of the wherewithal that he didn't have to work anymore. And he used to do a lot of hunting and fishing, flew an airplane, went out, but then he finally quit doing that. I don't know whether it was because he couldn't fly anymore from a physical standpoint, that is, he couldn't get another medical ticket to fly, or whether he just lost all interest in it. But I know not too long before he died, I said, let's go out and do some hunting, or do some fishing. I said, we'll go up the country, and of course I had an airplane too, and that's my airplane down there. And he didn't want to. And he did a few little things at home for people, and that was about the size of it.
Did anybody ever try to get him back out?
Oh, yes. Yeah, Dr. Romig was a great friend of his. He was over and talked to him a great deal and tried to get him back out. There was an FBI, ex-FBI agent, what the hell's his name, lived just close by there. He was a gunnery training officer for the FBI, and then later on I think he was a gunnery training officer for police departments and whatnot over the state. A.B. Clark. And A.B. Clark was a good friend and a close friend, and he tried to get him to shape up and get out and get fighting again, and he wouldn't do it. And then there was another ex-FBI agent, I can't think of his name either, was a very close friend of his, and he tried to get him to get out and do something, and he just had given up. It is the way I think. Because I know we were sitting here one day looking out the window and having a beverage, and I said, well, why don't you get in there and give him a couple of kicks in the ass and get going again? He says, hell, he says, it isn't worth it. And that was the end of that.
Did the practice change a lot for him? The law practice itself, or was it the politics more that he didn't
want to
get up and face? What do you think?
Well, he wasn't interested at all in politics after he finally got out of the legislature. He never went. I tried to get him to run again, and he said, no, it's nothing doing. And Greening wanted him to run later on, wanted him to run for the Senate when Greening was in, you know. And he says, there's no moose in Washington, D.C. He didn't want to, even if he could have won, he didn't want to go back there. I think it probably was because as far as practice was concerned, gosh, he could have had all the criminal practice in the world if he wanted it here in the community. But I don't know, maybe he was just tired of fighting. Because when he got on a case, he worked like a dog. And he had a high percentage of trials, because his thesis was that when he got the case, he went into it in depth, he got everything lined up, he got all his witnesses on paper and depositions and whatnot, so he was ready to go to trial anytime. And consequently, why oftentimes somebody didn't show up or something, why they'd call you, McCutcheon, you ready to go to trial? He says, sure, give me a few minutes to get my client, and away we go. So he had a very high percentage of courtroom work. And it was because that it was his theory that when you get the case, if you're going to accept it, get it put together and have it ready to go.
Did he stay in touch with any of the lawyers, like Wendell Kay?
I couldn't tell you. I don't know. I don't know. Roger Cremo was quite a great friend of his. They did a lot of hunting and fishing together and some other things. Roger Cremo could probably tell you some yarns about the situation.
Anywhere from a $50 fine or whatever the court thinks is appropriate. Up until this time, they have not thought too much was appropriate, except in what I consider now three horrendous cases where the result of the thing is really a smash with a sledgehammer over something which obviously could have been taken care of prior to that time. There's no explanation into here why the elapse of time did not lead to some other action by the court other than the final sanction of simply depriving one party of his day in court. Now, that's three cases out of what? This is opinion number 2500, so you'll just have to take your chances if you want to stonewall. There is a possibility you're on the lunatic fringe and you may lose your case. Anywhere in between that, it's some money or something of that nature. That basically takes care of discovery in the sense that wide open, you can get whatever you want. There are no limitations to who you bring into the case. There's no limitation on the information. There's no limitation upon your diligence. You don't have to be diligent at all. You can wait until the other guy prepares his case and ask for it. Mm-hmm. Now, the only problem is the choice to try and pick the proper method to get the material. Again, like pleadings, theoretically, if you can just file the papers, even written out in one hand, there is no reason why at this point you shouldn't be in possession of almost as much information about what's going on as anybody can reasonably get. Once you get the discovery to a point where you are rationally ready for trial, then there is the Rule 16 pretrial procedure by the court in which theoretically at this point the court is to enter the picture and somehow simplify the issues which you're going to try. There is an exact procedure set out in Rule 16 as to how you do this. Unfortunately, it's not used in Anchorage. Rule 16 is basically unused. There is no simplification of issues. You can petition for a pretrial conference, and you're more likely to get a settlement conference, but you very seldom get one which does other than set the trial of the case. The reason it was done for some years ago, it was felt that at a very early stage, it was very hard to get control of a particular case, and it was better to let the lawyers go ahead and try and prepare the case. The only real time that you find the court taking any type of control is if there's a large case or there's a large number of people involved and they're making a stab at trying to set up discovery schedules simply so everybody doesn't run off and in all directions and simply set up all kinds of discovery which you have to do over and over again. If you have 10 plaintiffs and one defendant, theoretically they can all go their separate ways and they can all file the same number of discovery motions, depositions, pleadings, requests for this and that, and some control is really necessary. The court is now looking at this idea of extensive litigation and may come up with something, but as of this moment, there is none. Okay, once you get to that particular point, theoretically, there are two things that have happened. Alaska, in all civil cases, you have jury trial. In all cases, you are entitled to peremptory challenge of judges, which is basically somewhat unique in Alaska. And those two things are really important. Now, the peremptory challenge to judge things is of substantial importance because it gives you the right to choose. Each side has one challenge to who will be a judge in a particular case. The judges do not like peremptory challenge of judges. for reasons which I have never been able to determine. It seems to me anything that would remove work from you would be something which you would devoutly enjoy, but they take it as a personal affront. And it is not intended that way. We have judges that are brilliant in some things that are absolutely unbelievable in others. And no one lawyer has the full 180-degree or 360-degree spectrum of all legal thought. And therein, their practice may have been in certain areas and not in others. And it is reasonable to want a judge to try your case that knows something about it. And my theory was, if you didn't want me on them, thank God. Because you have plenty of work to do. But it has caused all kinds of problems. And therefore, because of this distaste which judges hold for them, we have rather unique opinions on when waiver takes place in your failure to challenge your favorite judge. I mean, theoretically, 5 days after he's assigned, you can make a challenge to the judge. Now, that's straightforward, Ed. However, we have gone through the assignment of every judge to every case, which I thought was rather remarkable, and you try and pick which one is going to end up with it. You use your challenge, that only leaves 13 others. The Supreme Court struck that one down. There was, wait till he comes out on the bench and see who it is. The Supreme Court said that doesn't make any difference, he's out too. We've had a whole series of various methods by which you try to outguess counsel and give it to this. And we now have the rule that basically it comes back to if he has made some ruling on the merits. Now you thought, that really has something you can get your teeth into. However, there was a case from Kodiak here, which I participated in as an attorney, where they held that a 12B motion for failure to state a cause of action was a decision on the merits and you waived your right to challenge the judge, which is nothing short of ludicrous as a practical matter, because based on the whole theory of pleading, you would never get a case dismissed on a 12B motion, which on the sufficiency of the pleadings. Now that is and there are other cases which say that they're at some early stage you may waive. And of course the problem is that there is another problem in all of these areas where you have a single judge. Do you presume because it's filed in Bethel or Nome or Kotzebue or down at Kodiak that because it's a single judge you challenge that judge? We've had a lot of strange things on that, and now the single judge assigns himself to the case. But again, theoretically, you have 5 days to challenge. You can't wait for any reason, and it's earlier rather than later. And if the proceeding goes on at all, you run the risk of waiving your challenge, period.
I'm sorry, your period starts 5 days after
his assignment.
And
right.
You have 5 days.
You have 5 days. And if you do anything after that, or if you somehow say you don't have notice or something like that, if you don't hit that 5-day period, you really have a difficult time getting the judge off. Now, theoretically, if you want to get him off, you challenge him, and then you appeal the ruling. If he refuses to disqualify himself, you appeal for a ruling, and it goes to the presiding judge, who then hears and denies your challenge. And that takes care of that. Go ahead.
Is there a practical problem in that in Anchorage, at least, the assignment takes place at the time that you filed the lawsuit? Normally, a defendant has maybe 20 days to answer. If it's a private defendant, most defendants wouldn't even know that that rule existed by the time the defendant ever got it together to get to an attorney, the time would have passed.
Well, I have a case from down at Homer where that happened, and they said as long as the defendant does not know it, and by the time he gets to an attorney, in this case the public defender, he then had 5 days to exercise it, which is only common sense. But I suspect there is a real problem there of notification or getting to the attorney. Sometimes you theoretically might get to the public defender only to be told that you're not eligible, and therefore by the time another 5 days go by, or 10 days, or 20, or 25, which is more likely, and you may find you've waived your challenge. I mean, it is a real problem. And the other problem is in multi-judge districts, you may not know, it may be assigned to X person. You come in for trial, they say he's stuck in that case, it's now Y. And you have a practical problem of determining, are you going to take that person off right then and deprive yourself of trial? So you don't, theoretically, you've waived by that time when it gets into assignment in a multi-judge district, but it is a problem. You theoretically do not get the actual time because you really don't know who the judge is going to be. And that's one, yes.
In the case of co-plaintiffs or co-defendant, is it one per side or one per side?
One per side. One for, and the side is really attorney and client. And theoretically, even though there are these multi-party things, they still say, even though you may have conflicting interests, that there's only one to be exercised on a side, no matter how many the number of parties are. It does not apply on appeal to superior court judges, and we have this crazy thing now on appeals, the difference between administrative appeals and appeals from the district court, which I can't make head or tail out of. One, on administrative appeals, you can challenge the judge, and on appeals from district court, you can't, I think. But there's no reason for it, because, I mean, an appeal is an appeal, and theoretically you've already had a decision, so we're not talking about the same theoretical bias which a judge would have. If he handles it on appeal, that's on the record, is entirely different than him hearing the case on a original.
Yes. Is there any restriction at foot appellate level the challenge can be exercised?
You can't exercise it in the Supreme Court. That's the only thing that's clear. Apparently, that would seem to drop down to the Court of Appeals if you follow that case to its logical conclusion. But however, you can challenge the Superior Court acting in an appellate capacity, only in administrative appeals, I think is right. And why that is, I can't tell you. Why that should be of any difference, it doesn't make any sense. But that's the rule, or that's the stated case decision is practical.
Sorry, I'm not clear. The right to challenge on appeal applies to administrative appeals only, or in?
Yes, only administrative appeals to the Superior Court, because they go from the agency to the Superior Court. It does not apply from District Court to Superior Court, and it does not apply from the Superior Court to the Court of Appeals or to the Supreme Court. So it's only in that one. And you say why, and I can't tell you. There's no logic to say why it should be one as opposed to the other. But that was there are two cases came down at the same time. One said, yes, you can challenge, and that was 3-2, and the other one said, no, you can't challenge, that was 2-3. So, I mean, obviously somebody felt administrative appeals were slightly better than, or needed more help than appeals from the district court. That's all I can tell you. You want to?
5-3.
Okay. But basically, the exercise of challenges to a judge is really important. And I'm only being slightly facetious when I say that judges really, like every other lawyer and every other human being, have blind spots, or have spots where they have a lack of really experience, knowledge, background, and so forth. And you can take a case which you have nothing, know nothing about, you're thrown into a very busy thing, and do a terrible job in it. And there's nothing that's going to give you any more knowledge until the next case comes along, which you do another terrible job in, if it's of the same type. You don't really get any knowledge sitting on the bench in that sense, because you don't have time to, nor do you have time to build on. You really don't know when you decide a case whether you're way over on the left or way over on the right, because you don't have time to really look at the whole thing to try and decide where you are. And you will never see that type of a case again until it comes in another totally, what I would call, just single context, and you're asked to make another decision. You know it may be different than this point over here, but you're still really not any more sure whether you're in the middle or over on the other side. So basically, if you didn't have the knowledge when you got to the court, you're not going to get it there unless it's totally accidental. Now, we're not talking about practice problems where you have evidence or this type of thing. You're talking about knowledge in a very esoteric sense. Maybe it's a valuation problem on something, or if it's some type of contracts problem or something like that. You just may not know anything about it. You may have never practiced that way. You may have never heard of it. And therefore, you're not really going to do a very good job in deciding the thing. So why a judge should take that as a personal affront is something which I can't understand. Okay, that's the end of that editorial comment. You can cut that part of it out. Yeah, that is one of the problems which you have in the judge area. Now, the next aspect of where you have, which is extremely important, again, is in jurors. And jurors in Alaska, of course, we have an interesting problem, because early on the court had decided that as many of these cases as possible should be tried in the area where they take place. We have a wide divergence of ethnic background. We have different customs. We have like four states. I mean, you can't have a more divergent view from southeastern Alaska to Anchorage, from the Aleutian chain to Barrow, and literally have different types of people, different types of philosophies, and it's extremely difficult to try a case in Anchorage that arises in Barrow, and it's a hell of a lot different in Nome than it is in Juneau. And so, therefore, the court is committed to the idea that in order to get some type of reasonable justice in both civil and criminal cases, you've got to try these cases where they actually occur. Now, the philosophy is a good one, but there's a practical problem. If you read who an impartial juror is, there are a list of those jurors who are challenged by cause. And early on, in a case which Ken has to bear responsibility for, has tried 3, 4, 5 times, we took out this question of, it was involved, Malva versus J.C. Penney, and they took on this issue of jurors and when should jurors be excused and for cause and that type of thing, and they initially did not excuse those people who had charge accounts with J.C. Penney. Well, that seems rational. I mean, after all, if you owe JCPenney $200, does that mean that any suit against JCPenney's you're going to automatically favor him? On the contrary, you're probably going to go the other way. But as a practical matter, the court said that that is a debtor-creditor relationship and is a challenge for cause under the statute. Now, nobody thought about native land claims, all the people in an area belonging to the same organization, village co-ops where everybody hooks up to the same electricity, small telephone companies, I mean, until ad infinitum. So basically, you're confronted with a problem in the bush areas. Are the jurors excluded? Because the case says if they come within one of the exemptions set forth, that you must discharge them from the jury because they're presumed to be, it is potentially favorable to the one of the parties, and therefore they should be excluded. And there are, we use an example, the first case that came along immediately thereafter was a case against Kodiak Electric, Larman versus Kodiak Electric. Well, you couldn't find a juror who wasn't hooked up to Kodiak Electric if you had electricity. If you didn't have any electricity, that was fine, but they couldn't get enough jurors that weren't hooked up to electricity. So therefore, the case had to be brought from Kodiak over here to be tried. The same thing goes on in all of the other areas where you have jurors of identifiable groups. And I use the native land claim settlement thing and the regional corporation as a distinct problem. Because what do you do when the person who is the plaintiff is a member of one of the village or regional groups and you're trying the case like in Kotzebue? Are those people automatically excluded? Nobody can answer that, but it is a potential problem at this point. We still haven't rationally come to it, except they're in the rule. It seems to say that when you're talking about, like, the state of Alaska, and the jurors must not be able to work in the city or the state in the exact department that you're suing. That excludes them. But nobody has tried to filter this thing down and put into its parameters. So you do have this problem of trying to fit jurors into our theory of where you're going to try this particular case. Now, there is only one other problem in the juror areas. Of course, it also comes out of the Malvo case, which says because there is a potentiality for abuse or lack of impartiality where people belong to groups which consciously discriminate, just the disclosure that they may belong to such a group is sufficient to allow inquiry into their motives, why they joined the organization, and to see whether or not, in fact, they're impartial. Now, this came up by the fact that one of the jurors was on and belonged to the Elks Club, which has at that time had a restriction against Negro people. The plaintiff was Negro. They inquired into why they were members of the Elks, which constantly discriminated. There was a limitation of that inquiry in the original Malvo case, I believe, and the court said, even though they reversed it on that on the grounds that they had not followed the statute on cause, that they had a right to inquire into the basis for the reasons why people were belonging to organizations which practiced some form of discrimination. And therefore, that is an area of inquiry of jurors. They, however, were careful to sort of limit that, and the new rules of evidence clearly limit the idea of inquiry into religious preferences. So they do not permit you to inquire into religion, but they do into your choice of social or professional organizations, which can be whether wide-ranging. Now, this is all theoretical, because if the judge, in fact, selects the jurors, you're going to have a very difficult time inquiring into their background, because you're supposed to submit the questions in writing in advance. And if you've ever questioned a juror through a judge, you'll understand how difficult the process is. You seem to have a great deal of resistance to caring for your ideas as to what you may consider prejudice on behalf of the individual juror. I do not know a judge alive who cannot select a jury in an hour. He finds that the prejudice that you may feel exists is greatly overblown and therefore just simply cuts you off in your inquiry. Okay.
Take a break.
Take a break. There are two areas for jury trial which we ought to discuss here because they're somewhat unique to Alaska. One of them is in the area of juvenile cases on the decisional process as to whether or not the juvenile has committed an act which would have been a crime under the criminal law. The juvenile is entitled to a jury trial. Now, in almost all other jurisdictions, that's not so. It is done as a matter of Alaska constitutional law, which says the Alaska Constitution mandates jury trial in all trial phases of juvenile actions. If a juvenile is going to be placed in jail, he's entitled to a jury trial. Okay. There is another area where we have jury trial which is unique, and that is in any contempt proceeding where you would get even one day in jail or a fine, and the suggestion in the case is a fine over $400 or $500 or loss of a valuable right. I said the assumption might be your driving license or that sort of thing. You are also entitled to a jury trial if you request it. You're supposed to be told you're entitled to a jury trial and waive it for any type of contempt proceedings. Now, if you're familiar with the federal court sort of has a rule of thumb. If they announce in advance that the punishment is not going to be more than 6 months, you don't get a jury trial, which is, they say that up to 6 months, it's really a minor offense. Over 6 months, you get all your panoply of rights, counsel, trial, etc. And so if you've ever been in federal court, the judge always announces when he wants you to go away for 5 months and 29 days that this is not a serious matter and he's going to hold a contempt hearing immediately. And you're not entitled to counsel, a statement of charges, or a jury trial, and you leave for 139 days or 159 days instantly. In Alaska, it's sort of one day. If he says, I'm going to put you in jail, you say, all right, I want my jury trial. And in the case, which is a matter of Alaska constitutional law, the theory was really, if it's going to be one day, you ought to have a trial on that issue. For direct contempt of court, we have statutory remedies which say that basically you only are entitled, the punishment is only a $100 fine. Now, these are statutory, and we never had much problem with that until the case of Bayless and Vermont or Continental versus Bayless and Roberts, where they tried to get at the idea, could the court really go beyond the $100 statutory fine? It was that a matter where the jurisdiction of the court was restricted. The case simply says that no. That the court has inherent power to do anything it wants to with regard to contempt. That initially it should give some comedy to the idea of what the legislature has said with contempt, but that the court really was not restricted by that. Sort of on the theory that if they didn't like what happened after they give you $100, it could be $500, $1,000, $2,000, whatever they felt, or bar you from the courtroom, that they could do any of those things in order to ensure that the trial process would take place. However, if they're going to put you in jail for even one day, you have to have a jury trial. Now, the only distinction made theoretically in the federal court up to 6 months is called civil contempt. Over 6 months is criminal contempt. In Alaska, civil contempt only designates one thing. That is where you hold the key to get out of jail yourself. That is, in the child custody case, the party that secretes the children goes to jail until they cough up the children or make sure they're brought back to the jurisdiction of the court. Where you're ordered to sign a deed, you go to jail until you sign it, so forth. If you refuse to testify in court, you're taken to jail until you agree to testify or until the trial is over, at which time it's automatically converted to criminal contempt and you have a trial on that issue. But that the concept of civil contempt in Alaska does not go through the penalty phase. If you got a penalty, that's criminal contempt, and that's entitled to a jury trial. Those are two rather, as far as I know, Alaska is the only jurisdiction in the United States which makes that type of a distinction. There are a number of states which follow the federal, but which have cut it down to 90 days. And I still fail to see a distinction between 190 and 180, but I mean, that's the way the federal law is. Supreme Court of the United States has said that due process does not require you having notice and a hearing and a trial, even though you go to jail for 180 days. And so that's basically what's come out of it. The jury trial end of it, there are two states which I think have just recently held that juvenile cases jury trial is required. Interestingly enough, there's a huge hue and cry when both cases came down saying you would flood the court with all kinds of jury trials on these issues. To my knowledge, there's only been three criminal jury trials in the case of juveniles, and there have probably been six or seven in the cases of contempt. So you will have to judge for yourself whether or not they really had any more than a passing mention of what people thought might happen. Okay, once you get your trial and your judge and your discovery out of the way, of course, the basic thing it comes down to is you have the trial. And the scheduling of the trial, of course, is solely up to the court. And the court generally follows the practice of assigning the cases for trial within 120 days of the time when they're of the trial setting conference. Now, if you look through the rules, there isn't anything in there that says anything at all about trial setting conferences. However, in every single case, there's a trial setting conference. Now, it's like I point out, Rule 16 says a lot about pretrial conferences. They don't hold pretrial conferences. It says nothing about trial setting conferences. They always hold a trial setting conference. And the trial takes place within a certain fixed period of time after that for a reason. Practice is held that in Alaska, strangely enough, if it goes beyond 120 days between the date of setting and the date of trial, it is more than 50% likely that the case will not be able to go to trial on that date. That's one of the reasons why you don't schedule them a year in advance either. 90% of those scheduled a year in advance do not go to trial. That's just a practical problem. Also, in a multi-judge court like you have in Anchorage, you have to stack cases. On any Monday morning, there are 3.5 times the number of cases set for trial than could possibly be accommodated by the number of judges available. 80% of the cases settle out solely for the reason that there is a reasonable possibility they may go to trial. The stack system is worked out by a mathematician. It works invariably until all the cases want to go to trial on some Monday morning, and then the whole thing really creates a tremendous mess. But there isn't any real way that you can handle cases of large in a court which has 8 or 10 judges other than in a stack system, because only a certain limited percentage of trials take place. For your information, Anchorage has more jury trials per capita than any city in the western United States. It also has almost as many jury trials as took place in the all of England 2 years ago. So we rely more on the jury than anything else. Incidentally, they also try more jury trials in Fairbanks than they do in Anchorage. They only have 4 judges in Fairbanks and they have 9 in Anchorage. So you'll have to, the statistical morass is fairly large, but in any event, we have a large number of jury trials. The trial of the case is exactly what you'd expect it to be, and anybody who's ever watched television will know one guy gets up and says, this is the opening statement, and the other guy says, I disagree, and you're off from there. After you get the formality of the judge and the jury and the opening statement out of it, nobody says what happens when the guy doesn't get up and say anything. There's nothing in the rules which says that other than the plaintiff has to get up for the plaintiff's counsel and say what the trial is about. I participated in a trial where the defense counsel refused to say what he was going to do. And the court thumbed through the rules for a long period of time, finally threw in the sponge, indicating that he didn't have to say anything. You would presume he did, he doesn't. So therefore you can respond or not respond depending upon what you want to do. At that point, you get in the trial, and of course, the burden of going forward is basically upon the party plaintiff. That is not totally true, but it is close enough to the fact that we give it a great deal of credence. The rules of evidence then come into play, and I want to caution you when we read the rules of evidence. It says over and over again through them, if you have some complaint that you should have raised it before the trial, if there is some esoteric point of evidence you want to get across, there is the thread which runs through the whole thing that you have waived it if you have not had a hearing before the judge. Now, you may not think that's of great importance, but that is also stressed by Mr. Saltzman, who wrote the 2 books, one on the Federal Rules of Evidence and who drafted the Alaska Rules of Evidence. And in his book, he takes a very strong position that the judge should let anything in, including the kitchen sink, if you have not had a hearing before the trial. That is exactly what the judge will do, as a matter of fact. So the limitations which you see in the rules of evidence as you read them are really evaporate if you have not had a judge's ruling on them before the trial. And that is not to say he may not consider them, because he can do anything he wants to. But your chances are less than 1 in 4 he will. So the prospect, as you read them before, they say over and over again, this issue should be called to the attention of the trial judge. I mean, it may go from something on impeachment to conviction of a crime. It may go to the capacity of the witness to testify. It may go to his ability to understand the difference between right and wrong. It may go to anything. And the suggestion is that there is an automatic waiver if you don't challenge it in advance. So the judge is too up on you to start with. The court, in every single case where it's not raised in advance of trial, can hold you waived, and that will be affirmed by the Supreme Court, because that's the way the rules are written. But a fair warning in advance. Okay, then you go down and try and pick out the traditional rules of the scope of evidence. And basically, the judge is the sole arbiter of the scope. That means relevancy, etc. And he is empowered in the rules, starting with Rule 1, to decide that matter which he's going to exclude on the basis that it may be relevant but prejudicial. Incidentally, that's an objection you hear. It's always prejudicial. Any evidence which is extremely damaging is terribly prejudicial. It is also admissible. And you'll hear over and over again, I object, it's prejudicial. It certainly is. Any eyewitness account of you committing a crime is terribly prejudicial. Older attorneys say that in prey. Under the scope, it is possible, however, that the judge may say yes on some more esoteric point. He's certainly not going to keep out eyewitness testimony on the basis that it's prejudicial. On the other hand, some terribly damaging set of circumstances may be kept out. I think the outstanding example we have now is a trial in Atlanta, where you have being tried for 2 murders, and they put in a lot of evidence on 9 more. That really seems to be fairly close to the line in the prejudicial sense, unless you get some sort of what we call the fingerprint type crime, in the sense of a pattern crime. There did not seem to be a pattern crime, but that basically is what we're talking about in not letting you get very far afield. And that's what these rules are designed to prevent, by making that evidence be presented to the judge before the trial and make a ruling upon it, or it would not be admissible. In Alaska, all of that evidence would have had to been presented in hearing prior to the time of the trial and a ruling made by the judge, or you would never have been able to do anything from that point. Now, the suggestions we get from Atlanta seems there may be something of that in it, but it seems to me under our rules and the content of the prejudice that you would not get that evidence in. The other thing is in Rule 102, which says purpose and construction, says these rules shall be construed to secure fairness in administration, elimination of unjustifiable expense and delay, and promotion of growth and development of the law of evidence to the end that truth may be ascertained and proceedings justly determined. And then there is a fanfare from bugles after that. What it really means is that the judge can construe these rules in the interest of justice as he sees fit, and he is only then there will only be a reversal if in fact he abuses his discretion. Now, in order to abuse his discretion, it must mean that his decision is totally without foundation in any of the English-speaking world, and that's basically what discretion in the admission of evidence means. So the rules are designed to bring in the maximum amount of evidence. Now, I want to start with one thing, which these are only set forth peripherally in the rules, but which talk about the actual ability of people to testify in court. You have all been taught that there are certain classes of people which simply cannot be witnesses, people that have previously committed perjury. We have the dead man statute. We have certain juveniles. We have a tender years doctrine that you can't. People who are incapable of expressing some type of religious or ethical belief in truth. Certain types of addicts who are incapable either of observing or of relating what they observe. That type of thing. There are no such restrictions in Alaska. So the competency of somebody to testify is really not a problem. Everyone can testify. We have some old cases which are basically enshrined in the commentary, and I think the most outstanding example, I think, is the McMasters versus State case, which has literally, strangely enough, been repeated in a case which just came down on the videotape of a young child, which was permitted into evidence on a reenaction of a crime. McMaster's is a case where a 5-year-old girl observed her mother shoot the father. She was the only witness. Mother testified it was self-defense. Child testified seemingly to 2 or 3 different kinds of stories, as you would basically assume, but the substance of what she saw, daddy turn his back and mama take the gun out of the drawer and blast it, which really, and then at the time of trial, then really wandered all over the lot, but part of that did get in. Now, that was, they did not swear that child to tell the truth. There was no, she actually testified without any oath or affirmation, even though now in these evidence rules they require some type of oath or affirmation. There was an attempt by Judge Fitzgerald, who was a Superior Court judge handling the trial, to ascertain whether or not the child knew the difference between right and wrong and would be more likely to testify as to the truth as opposed to something else. He satisfied himself but would not say an oath wouldn't make any difference, and the child testified. Now, there was another rather unique thing in the case in that when it came time for her to, they wanted to say, well, didn't you say another story? Well, you cannot, even though the law requires a foundation for impeachment, it's impossible to lay a foundation with a child. So they just launched into this as best they could without any foundation and tried to get some type of impeachment going. And it later went up on appeal on 2 or 3 grounds. 1, she did not have the capacity to testify. 2, she wasn't sworn. 3, there's no foundation for what happened and the impeachment aspects of it. And all of it was turned down. The court said basically, well, we'll let this happen forever, for whatever it's worth. Now, interestingly enough, the rules of evidence did come down very recently, and we had a similar case of a murder where a young child was videotaped immediately after the event to reenact the crime. Similar type thing. When it came time for trial, the child had no recollection of what it said or the event. The videotape was shown to the jury as an exception to the hearsay rule. Now, the exception cited in the case is the one on impeachment. But since they didn't know how it could be impeachment, nobody has explained, nor does the opinion explain. However, there is an exception which is not mentioned, and that is recorded testimony at the time of the event, which is an exception to the hearsay rule under the rules of evidence. I just simply point out that you literally, in this case, the child did not testify. At trial, the child was under oath. But the child said, I don't remember anything. Therefore, the videotape was substituted for the entire testimony of the child. It, of course, was not under oath. So, what I say again, if you talk in terms of capacity, the child probably would not have been permitted to testify. There's some question of capacity. The only other issue which apparently raises for capacity, simply because we have never confronted it, is a question of what types of drug users are capable of testifying. Whether or not they've reached a point of distortion in actual relating of testimony or in observation, which makes them unreliable as witnesses. Now, strangely enough, the only case we have is of a heroin addict who literally had shot up before the event, observed it in slow motion, and was relating it afterwards, which appeared to be of some reliability. In some view of the psychological implications of that, I'm not going to say I'm an expert in what heroin addicts do, but they felt that if he'd been in the advanced stages, and it says so in the opinion, of if it had been too long in between shots on his part, he might not have been a reliable observer. It so happened that this particular addict also had a shot before he testified at the trial, so they did not feel that he was distorting at the trial, in order for some reason. I mean, it does have some endless problems that you can imagine. You vary the type of poison, and then you come to your own decision as to whether or not you can either observe or relate. Now, that's happened in at least 3 cases as a practical matter, but it does have to do with capacity. Okay, now the ability to relate or in the sense of some sort of ethical background, truth as opposed to lies, I don't know how you confront that. And the rules of evidence do not. They simply assume everybody can be a witness. However, as a practical matter, if there's any question when you get down to the courthouse, you will have a practical problem convincing the judge that the people does understanding the obligation which is placed upon them by some oath or affirmation which is required in the rules of evidence. Now that's an aside, simply because it does come up far more often than you might think possible, and it always comes up in the case of children. Okay, the rules of evidence are very straightforward, and you go through them, and I can read them to you in the sense of what each one of them does. I don't think that's a very productive way to do it. And what I'm going to do here is thumb quickly through some of them, which have some variations of the previous law, and simply point out some things to you that basically will cause problems in the trial of the case. Probably the biggest area is the privilege area, in which we have outlined certain privileges which are traditional with some minor exceptions. The only thing that the privilege area starts out with, which I call to your attention, it says nobody can be refused to be a witness, which is a very, unless there is a privilege. And so all of the reasons why people do not want to get involved or that sort of thing are simply unavailable unless the testimony is privileged. It has come up on many times where people in the villages particularly do not want to be witnesses. There is a problem with the Eskimo culture in our confrontation and adversary sense, which is not basically compatible. Their theory is more oriental in origin, in that the confrontation aspects of it are simply not part of their cultural heritage. As a practical matter, they've lived with theirs a hell of a lot longer than we live with ours, and was more successful, and why we want to force ours off is a matter of some sociological dispute at the present time. But basically, we are forcing upon their cultural this idea of confrontation. It does not fit very well, and there are a large number of the people who do not want to be witnesses to accuse, because they find that in a small setting in the village where you become a witness or an accuser, it makes it difficult to live together easily and harmoniously thereafter. Okay, a very logical assumption. They have refused to be witnesses. Under the rules of evidence, that's not permissible. So it is a problem that came up a number of times, particularly in the second judicial district, barreled that type of thing. There are a lot of people that do not want to testify from preference. Okay. In the privilege area, of course, we have the lawyer-client privilege, which belongs to the client, and which basically means that what you disclose to your lawyer or through someone who represents the lawyer theoretically is not available for discovery or testimony at trial. We found a very interesting concept which is developing lately in the practice in almost every large case, and that somewhere in the middle of it, one of the attorneys involved wants to take the deposition of the other. It is not by any means unique. We found it in at least four or five major cases where we're involved in, and we have been called in, I've been called as a witness in several cases where I was peripherally involved, and now they want to take my deposition. Of course, you can only go and say, I'm sorry, my client asserts the privilege. And so the question is really to do with this rather strange type of proposal. And of course, the only thing that can be solved by it is you have to go down to the judge, and in court, they have to ask you all the questions so they can rely on the privilege, because you can only waive the privilege by testimony over the objection of your client by, at your peril. It is his privilege. And the presumption in the rule is that you presume that he does not consent to waiver the privilege. So that is one thing which is going on in the practice now, which causes a fairly substantial thing. Alaska also has expanded the physician and the physician-patient privilege to physician-psychotherapist privilege, and even expands the concept of medical privilege and psychotherapist to members of the family of the party who may carry out the instructions of the psychotherapist etc. Now, basically, where the encyclotherapy thing comes up is in criminal cases. And the original case which gave rise to the rule of evidence was a case in which a man confessed to murder after asking to talk to his counselor. Now, the counselor was not a psychologist, was not a psychiatrist, was a like someone he talked to in the neighborhood mental health clinic. And the contention was that he would not have confessed if he was not, if he had not given confidence or had confidence in this particular person. There was one problem, and the problem is raised in the dissent, and that is, how far do you carry this idea that people will are counseling and therefore are within the scope of the privilege? And of course, there's no answer to that. If you do not say it has to be a doctor, and if you notice the doctor-patient privilege doesn't say nurse practitioner, midwife, etc., but the psychotherapist thing has gone that way, and we are really down on the outer limits of it in the rule. And the rule specifically, if I can find the last person, I was sort of going over it, who had the...
For cassette students, this is the end of side one. Please turn the tape over at this point and continue playing it.